honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You heard from Angie Sciappi, one of America's Rosie the Riveters during World War II. And now we're hearing from her husband of 70 years, Vince, who spent 3 years in the U.S. Army. He had to lie about his age to get in, but before we get to that, you were a boy, Vince, with your brothers off serving in World War II. So I wonder if you remember what it was like for your parents to have two sons risking their lives overseas.
Oh, my mother cried and all the time. She would write letters to my brothers. They would write back, and then she would read them to me. It would be half Italian, half English. Brought up in an Italian family like that, I was able to understand a lot of it. I couldn't write it. I could understand their language from their part of Italy. And she'd sit down and she'd read it to me and all that, and then she'd write back and everything. And
were your brothers the reason that you got into the Army?
I was 15.
15?
Yes, 15 and a half. My mother signed me off. Get rid of this kid. Get him out of here. He's
all
on
right.
the run.
Give me the whole story now. What what was going on here?
Yeah, 47 I went in.
47. So you're 15 and a half. And what, you're just so much trouble they wanted you out of the house?
I wasn't bad trouble. I was just, I like to be on my own. I'm still the same way. I went to barber school in Boston, and I enjoyed it and graduated and all that. And I still cut her hair, you know, I know how to do it.
Right.
So, but anyway, not getting into a lot of trouble or anything like that. I just like to go wherever I wanted to go. I'd take off from Cambridge, go to Boston all by myself, and go to the beach there or wherever, you know, under the Charles River and MIT, go to the college there and just wander around, you know, just a juvenile that shouldn't be doing things like that, you know.
So you weren't fond of school?
I wasn't fond of school at all. When I was there, I would learn. I just didn't like being trapped.
So you're 15 and a half years old. How old did you have to be to get in the Army?
17, I think it was.
If you were 17, your parents could sign for you and they'd let you in. So how did you pull this off to convince the Army that you were actually 17 when you were 15 and a half?
My mother signed for me and set a different age.
Did she like forge a birth certificate or a baptism record or something?
You know, in those days when I went in 47, they didn't check so much on a lot of things. And they were coming out of the service from the war, World War II, so they needed to fill those spots with new people. I said, heck yeah, I'll go. You know, and to me it was an adventure. I thought, hey, this would be nice, be on my own and not realizing you got to go by the rules. When you're in the Army, buddy, they make it tough on you if you don't. But I liked it. I really did. I told them I was born in 1928, you know, when I was really born in 31. So that put me at 17. And a recruiting sergeant just signed the papers and everything. Okay, come on back. We'll swear you in next week. Put my hand up. I swore in. Away I went.
Did anybody ever figure it out?
No.
Did anyone ever think you were too young?
No. I had that young look, I think, but being a recruit, just going in, we were all young. Everybody was older than me. Actually, there was about four or five others from Texas that was my age or maybe a year older or something like that, and they found out about them, and they released them. I don't know what happened to them, but I know they weren't in my barracks no more.
Well, that had to get your attention.
Yes, it did. I was a little worried. I thought, oh, I'm going to prison. I said, oh, they're going to shoot me. They're going to fire. The firing squad is waiting for me, you know. And I didn't say nothing. I remember the sergeant saying in the barracks there, he says, anybody else in this barracks, you know? I just kept quiet, and I didn't say nothing. And I just coasted right through.
Tell me some of the things you did in the Army.
Going through training in Fort Ord, California. From there, we went on a ship up the coast of California to Washington, into the Puget Sound there, to a little base there, a little island, about 7 miles long, I remember, and 4 miles wide. And we had a training, and there was about 200 servicemen. So we were training there on LCVs and LCMs, uh-huh. the landing crafts.
So you're an amphibious unit?
36 combat engineers.
Uh-huh.
So we were training on that. We had some old junker boats. The captain said, there they are. Tear them down, put them back together. And we had some bulldozers there that we'd pull them out of the water and work on them, and had some old junker tools and just rip the engines apart, and whatever needed fixing, we'd put it together and push them back out in the water with the bulldozer and
just float around.
And then we knew that we were going to get new equipment when we had to go overseas. So we were just training on that. And that was good. I liked that.
But before you went overseas, there was something that actually happened on the West Coast that you guys responded to. And I'm thinking about recently, California's awful wildfires. The president actually awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross to some men who flew their helicopters in when they were told not to and saved people's lives. You were part of a different kind of natural disaster in the response to it.
They had a big hurricane that came into Oregon in the lower part of Washington. It just flooded the whole area, all that into the Columbia River. It's just south of Washington and the upper part of Portland, Oregon. The Columbia River comes in there to all those towns and everything. Because we had these flat bottom LCVPs and LCMs with a ramp in the front, they were the kind that would hit the beach and the troops would come out and storm the beach and invade. Anyway, they sent two of our boats. There was a three-man boat. It was the coxswain, the seaman, and the mechanic. And I was a seaman at that time. Anyway, the captain said, we need two boats to go down. And who wants to go? And I put my hand up. I didn't know where the heck we were going. Mm-hmm. I knew we had a big storm that had come in because it affected us up there in Washington. But they got hit hard. It was about 2 days after the storm had finally turned around and went back out to the ocean. It just flooded that whole area.
Vanport, was that the town?
Yeah. Anyway, we came down the ocean from upper Washington. I don't know how many miles that is, but it's got to be at least a few hundred miles. Went in there and said, what do we do? You know, we just asked people who just trying to save themselves with the water. The water was up to the eaves, to the windows, and people on roofs. And so they said, just go out there and pick up people. So we went up and down the streets and picking up people and babies and just families and whoever needed help, you know. And we'd have maybe 20, 30 people at a time in the boat. Take them back to dry land, to a dock or someplace. And by then, the Red Cross had come in and a few other people, and were serving people food and coffee and whatever. And we would just go out there and do whatever. We were just on our own, just two boats. We had packed up a bunch of sea rations. We had about maybe, six, seven cases of sea rations in our boat, just eating out of cans, whatever was in that box, and cigarettes and whatever they put in there. Finally, they started serving meals, and we were picking up a little food. But we were picking up people all the time and bringing them back into dry land, and then they'd find their own way from then on, you know. In my boat, I think, I would say we picked up, my boat alone, about 200 people. The water was just came in from the ocean, from the storm and everything, and it just flooded miles and miles of all into the Columbia River. It just went over the banks, went over everything. So we spent about 2 weeks there and just living out. We'd go in and we made sure, because our boats were flat bottom, we could tread water about maybe 3 feet, mm-hmm. you know, 2-3 feet, something like that. But then it got so that water started pushing out to the ocean, so we started backing off. And after about a week or so, people were finding their way around by then. I don't remember ever picking up anybody that was injured. Mostly everybody was just standing on their porches or on the second floor or somewhere on roofs and just waiting, you know, save us, help us, you know. So I was real proud of myself then. I was actually, to me, it was fun. They were in trouble, them people.
Yeah.
They were in real bad trouble.
What would have happened to them if you guys weren't there?
I'm sure somebody would have died. I'm sure of that. Because there was a lot of them. Not just some, there was a lot that was just coming out of the second floor windows, just hanging out the windows there, and we'd just drive right up alongside there, and they'd climb in our boat, and we'd take them to dry land. And the Red Cross would greet them and take over from there. And all they had was their children, their dog, whatever, their cat. But anyway, we spent 2 weeks there, and finally they sent a couple of soldiers down to see what was going on with us, because we didn't have no communication with them. We didn't have no radios, no telephones, no nothing. We didn't know the telephone, that the basis for nothing, you know. So we were just sitting there all by ourselves. We could have still been there, you know. Finally, they located us, and they said, hey, the captain wants you to come back, you know. You're not on vacation. So we loaded up our gear, whatever we had, and we just had a few pair of pants and a couple of shirts and things like that. And it was cold. I remember that. It was very cold. And up there, it's always raining all the time. Finally, we got some fuel. That was our worry, that we were going to run out of fuel, because we have two engines in those boats, and they just eat up the fuel like crazy. So we managed to get some fuel from a gas station that didn't get too much water. So we filled up our tanks and took off. We never paid them. So they never got a dime. I don't know how they got their money back on it, but we had no money. You know, sure. We had no money. We had no place to spend it. Everything was underwater.
It's got to be a surreal feeling to see all that.
It was something, and I think I was telling you earlier about a cow that we picked up.
So you picked up 200 people and one cow.
And one cow. We went out just outside of town there, and there was this cow out there all by himself, and the water was up to his belly. And he was just standing there just looking at us, and we slowed all the way down to just a crawl there. And we thought, well, we'll lower the ramp, and we can see if we can shoo him onto the ramp and get him into the boat. And we were just about maybe 30 feet away from him. All of a sudden, he just walked up into the ramp there and walked into the boat, like, and we didn't coach him in or nothing, just like as if we had a rope around his neck, you know. And we lifted the ramp, and we took off about maybe a couple of miles away, and we found some dry land and put the ramp down and just turned them loose. So I guess whoever owned them found them eventually. I know he had a big band around his neck, so he probably had a number or something. And it was the craziest thing. We laughed about that all the time. That crazy cow, you know, he wasn't so crazy. He knew he wanted out of there, you know. So, anyway, it was an experience. But anyway, we went back up to Washington, went back to base and reported in. And the captain says, hey, go back to work. You know what you have to do. Get down to the motor pool and check in and go to work. Mm-hmm. Okay. We never got recognized for it. Never. No thank you. No nothing. You know?
And there were only two boats?
Two boats.
For the whole operation?
Yeah. There was other people on rafts or little skiffs, I guess you call them. Local people that had little boats of some kind. Fishing boats and things like that. And they were picking up people. But they liked us because we could pick up a lot, and we were flat bottom, and we could just pull right up alongside of a house, and people would climb on.
Have you ever had a chance to see any of those people again?
No, never. I think about it all the time that I would like to go up there and just drive around for a couple, 3 days, you know, and just look over the area.
So there were only six of you that participated in that?
Yeah.
Do you know if the other guys are still around?
I have no idea. I can't even remember what they look like now.
And how long did you stay in the service?
3 years, 47 to 50.
I don't want to leave anything out if there's something that's important to you, but I want to say thank you for serving our country. When you think about Thanksgiving, what is it that you're most thankful for?
I'm thankful for being an American. I thank my mother and father for coming here to this great country. I don't know how it would have been if I was born in Italy. And, of course, I would have been a young kid during World War II over there. I don't know if I would have survived. But I'm mostly thankful that I'm here and meeting my wife and having the family that I have. Like Angie says, we have four adopted children, and we're proud of that. Us not being able to have children, that was the route that we took. And here we are. Still married 70 years later, got a nice home. I'm not rich. I'm comfortable. And I'm proud that I served for my country. Maybe I didn't do as much as the other guy that got wounded or got killed or something. I feel for them that did get wounded and got killed. I feel great sorrow for their mothers and fathers. I had my first cousin that got shot down coming back from Germany in a B-24. From Africa, that was their base. They went over to bomb Germany over there, and they got hit by aircraft fire, and they were making their way back on fire, from what I was told, and they couldn't make it, and they crashed in Africa. And that was in 1944, and they didn't find the plane until 1952. I remember my aunt, she had to go back. She was living with my mother out here in California, And so she had to go back, and they brought his body back, you know, Matthew DeLuca was his name.
That picture on the wall of you and 70 other veterans at the World War II Memorial, behind you is a wall of gold stars, 406,000 Americans in World War II, and one of those hit really close to home for you.
That's right. And I think of him, I think of him a lot. I remember when I was young, he used to throw me up on his shoulders. He was a tall, lanky guy. I used to look at his arms, and he was just all muscle. He'd throw me, come on, Vinzine. He called me Vinzine for Vincent. He'd throw me up on his shoulders, and I thought, gee, this guy's really sharp, boy. I really enjoyed him, you know. He was like a brother to me, you know. And so when he got killed, anyway, they found their bodies, you know, in Africa in the jungles. The natives or somebody, I don't know who it was, but they ID'd him with their dog tags. Anyway, yeah, that was close. He was close to me, and then, but I was thankful, again, I say, for my brothers for coming back. They made it, and I made it. I have 2, 3, 4, 5 flags, American flags, hanging out off of my house right now. One on my lawn, 2 on the side here, and 2 off the garage doors. And they're there all the time. I salute them every day. This is my country. There ain't no other country that's like this country. And I'm proud that I serve for my fellow Americans.
Hey, one more question about Angie. With her being a Rosie, what does that mean to you?
Oh, I'm very proud of her.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of her. In those days, the women, they kept the home front going. With all the men over there, of course, they had the women's corps too. They did very well. They had no combat stuff like they do now, but nurses and whatever else. But they had to have somebody here in the shipyards, you know, just building whatever had to be built for the war front. And she was part of that. And I'm proud of her for doing that, you know. She did her part during World War II. You know, being a young girl, a ship is a ship. A boat is a boat, you know. All she knew is she had to weld something together, you know, and that was it, and go home and eat, come back to work, you know, but not knowing really what the war front was like. But I'm very proud of her for what she did.
America is proud of her. Soon, Angie and all the other Rosie the Riveters will receive the Congressional Gold Medal for their efforts all those years ago. We're out of time here on the radio, but there are a few more memories from the Chiappe family and the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, where you can also find a short video of Vince and Angie dancing like they have through 70 years of marriage. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving with your family if you're able to gather together. I know I am beyond thankful for the privilege of meeting all these amazing Americans and sharing all of their stories with you. And if you're like me, you never get tired of being reminded that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.